All right, let me start this fucker up.
There's your cold open.
Yeah.
We are. Right. We gotta start it again. It wasn't loud. Okay. So, all right, ready? We are streaming to your earbuds from an unspecified time, in an unclarified location, on an uncertified podcast, by an unsolidified lake, from inside an unambiguous art shed. I'm Matt Carl.
I'm Normal Andy.
I'm Producer Chris.
And I am Guest Mike.
Guest Mike.
Guest wow. Mike.
Mike. Guest Mike.
Yes.
Oh wait, somebody's gonna crack a beer.
Oh crap! I've already cracked my beer.
I have a bottle. So I have an interesting story about what happened during the break, and it has to do with the art shed. And
does it involve a possum?
No.
Okay.
So all right. So Guild Row kind of inspires me. Like I brew my own beer, right? So. I just got a new beer. It's a German alt beer I brewed, and it just bottle conditioned for 2 weeks, so it's just ready to crack. And I just cracked it, and it looks fucking awesome. My first beer, right, of this 5 gallons that I bottled, and so I was like, okay, I'll drink that beer sometime during the podcast. So I went outside, I put it in the snow. Like, because we have a ton of snow around here. And during the break, I'm like, okay, I'll go get the beer. And so it was kind of warm today. Like, we have a ton of snow, but it was kind of warm today in Massachusetts. But now it's cold outside. So I have a ramp going up to the art shed. It's not a stairs. It's just a ramp.
No, it's slippery on its own, so I can kind of imagine.
Yeah, it wasn't slippery when I came in, but when I'm coming out to get the beer, I slide down the thing, I grab the beer, and I can't get back up the fucking ramp. You know, like. So then I go to the road, because I'm off a side road, and I know the Salters, and I don't have my phone. My phone's charging in the shed, so it's completely dark. So I know the salters salt they don't salt evenly. They just like a pile of salt is in the middle of the road. So I just kind of go to the middle of the road and I graze my hand over the road and I find a pile of salt and I throw it on the ramp and then I'm able to climb up the nice. Back into the arch. Nice. So that was my little. Adventure.
Yeah, Carl. I mean, that's really funny, Carl, because this I go on a walk around where I live every day, and today on my walk I picked up a bunch of salt off the road to put on my front doorstep because it was all iced over.
Yeah. Right.
Oh. Yeah.
Carl, I was going to ask, did that actually happen to you, or are you just reading out of a Jack London book?
It actually happened. And
Carl, I know is Jack London.
I heard you talking about about chopping wood. I have cords of wood, and I heat my house with a wood stove. My house is a little fucking 800 square foot
Wasn't it built as a summer cabin originally?
It was built in 1940 as a summer cabin. 40s?
Okay, yeah. So, where you live is weird, just to put it in perspective for people who haven't seen it. It is. It's like an old lake house from the 1940s. And even though you're really close into Boston, it's still it's bizarre. When you say side road, I'd barely call that a road. Like what goes on the side of your house there?
It immediately turns into a dirt road.
Yeah. It's like you're in the woods, but you're in a close-in suburb of Boston, or fairly close-in, medium.
Yeah, it's weird around here. A lot of the the farmland grew in, but I think at some point this place was like a vacation place for when people had horses and buggies and they couldn't drive to the Cape or something like that. But anyway, this alt beer that I brewed, I got a special yeast for it that was like, it was called like Dieter or something like that. I don't know, it was like the name of it. It's like a top fermenting yeast, and then I guess alt beers are from the city of Dusseldorf. So I brewed like a traditional alt beer with like this traditional yeast. So it's pretty damn good. It's pretty nice. Damn good.
So nice. Did you brew that beer just so you could say Dusseldorf?
No, but it doesn't hurt, right?
Yeah.
Dusseldorf.
It's they have very good beer and very good mustard.
Oh, yeah, I love mustard. Mike, what are you drinking?
I actually am drinking I'm sorry to like be stumbling through the pronunciation. So I have a friend who runs a brewery incubator just down the street from Guild Row called Pilot Project Brewing. And so he has a kind of a monthly beer club by which he packages some of the most promising beers that the breweries he's incubating are doing. So this is like a totally new drink I'm drinking. It's by Azadi Brewing, Azadi Brewing. It is a Kavi, KAVI golden ale. And I'll read the description. It is inspired by the poetic landscapes of Kashmir. Our crisp golden ale offers hints of lemon, pepper, and cardamom to form a delightfully sessionable companion to a gathering with friends and family. As I recall from conversation with my buddy who runs Pilot Project, the incubator, this is one of the largest or first Indian American owned breweries in the U.S.
And I want that beer.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, I'm two sips in, but you know, they're not bullshitting you about the cardamom.
I feel like I'm in Zanzibar right now, wherever the hell you said you were.
Right.
Kashmir, like a Zeppelin song. Hey, can we, Chris, you want to introduce Mike? This is the second episode, and I don't think we just cold opened and didn't introduce him.
Oh, yeah, sure. So, so we're talking this week to Mike Healy, who is one of the founders of Guild Row in Chicago, which is a social club that is focused around getting people together to learn how to make things and just enjoy spending time together making different things and learning and being social.
You're hired, man. That's really well articulated.
Chris, you want to answer phones at Go Guild Row?
Yeah. I feel like I'm answering phones, having like a headset on and everything. I'm like, would you like a football telephone with your subscription?
Yeah. I wish I had Kashmir to play during his beer talking.
Well, that's just do it in the post.
Talking. No.
Beer talking.
Beer introduction. Andy, are you drinking anything interesting?
I am drinking a Midnight Oil Oatmeal Stout by Beard Brewing Company, and they're from Connecticut.
Holy shit, that ties into Kashmir, Midnight Oil, like a hashish.
Oh, dang.
Wow.
Now you know what it was like to hang out in a basement with Carl in high
school. Yeah, man. Right. Carl, you're or something. Yeah.
I imagine in Kashmir spice markets, you could buy some kubeb, right, Chris?
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you could. Could buy kubeb.
What are you drinking?
It's kubeb, actually. I actually had a really. I'm kind of ending a voyage to a blend. It's getting really close. This is awesome. So this was, what did I put in this? I put in pomegranate juice, dried figs, a lot of star anise, balsamic vinegar, kubeb, and some cloves, and balanced out with some sugar. And then I sous-vided that for about 3 hours. And when I opened it up this morning, like, so I started it first thing this morning, and then like around lunchtime, I poured it out, and it was really, the clove was really dominant. But so I just let it air out and breathe for a little bit. And now the clove has mellowed to a really nice point. And so now I'm mixing it about half that with half ginger beer. Wow. It's really nice.
Sounds awesome, man.
Yeah. I just want to say for posterity here, if I ever get stabbed by an evil wizard, I need my family to come to you to pick me up.
Yes,
exactly. Seriously.
It's pretty good. This is,
that sounds really good. Stuff.
My next step, I'm trying to figure out some way to use smoked lard in a drink.
Wow.
I'm not sure.
Yeah. I mean, you could make there's some German beers that taste like smoked lard.
Yes. Yeah. Rausch beers.
Yeah. Rausch beers. Yeah.
What does smoked lard taste like?
It's like, imagine bacon fat without salt.
Okay.
So I made a bunch of it just because I had my smoker running and I had all this lard, like lard that had to be rendered out. And I was like, hey, why don't I just grind this up? And once I was done smoking ribs or whatever, I don't even remember what I was smoking. So I put all of the ground up, you know, pork fat, it was leaf lard, into the smoker and just let it sit there for an hour as the smoker died down, and it rendered out all the fat and turned it into, like, you know, usable lard. And it just has this great smoky flavor, and it was delicious lard to begin with. So yeah, it's like bacon fat, but with no salt in it. So when you use it for cooking, to say like cook some Brussels sprouts in it or something, you can decide how much salt to add. It's not like bacon fat where you get, you know, a huge hit of saltiness no matter what you do.
Is it like fat back or whatever?
Yeah, well, this leaf lard is the pork fat that surrounds the liver of a pig. And it's the it has the best texture of any other part of pork fat. So it's used for baking a lot. It's rendered out to make doughs and pies and things like that. It makes a great pie crust.
So. My grandfather used to cook like vegetables in like bacon fat or something like that. It wasn't bacon fat, but it was like fat back or something lard, and it was freaking so good.
Yeah, it's a great flavor. Pork fat is just delicious. Yeah.
So, the glaciers. I know we were talking about the glaciers. They carved out a lot of the lakes in Massachusetts, and I heard Mike walk the Appalachian Trail.
I was wondering where you were going with that, Carl.
Yeah, I think both those things are true, but who can say?
Well, I think at the end...
Well, the glaciers walked the Appalachian Trail, too. So
they carved the Appalachian Trail.
I mean, certainly hiking the Appalachian Trail on the northern end, you certainly have a lot of firsthand exposure to the geology of glaciation.
You do. You certainly do. I mean, I don't. Do we want to like detour into talking AT? Because
yeah, I mean,
Chris is the trained professional here. I'm the stumble about.
AT, what's AT?
Appalachian Trail, Carl.
Oh, the subject
you brought up. Well, before we get started,
I retract my Jack London comment from earlier.
Yeah, exactly. I think we need to start with telling Carl and anyone else who's listening who doesn't know what the Appalachian Trail is.
Sure.
No, wait, hold on. I don't do acronyms here.
Yep.
Okay.
All right. Not okay. Well, I guess okay is not next.
Yeah, we don't do acronyms on WTTAS.
Exactly.
So how do we want to structure this? Like this little
start at the beginning. Glaciers.
Well, okay. Did you get? I mean, okay.
Why do you hike the Appalachian Trail?
I think we should toss it to Chris, who actually was paid to be one of the professionals maintaining and preserving the Appalachian Trail, to actually explain what it is.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I can do that. Yeah. And I was mostly just the northern section, but yeah, the Appalachian Trail is, I want to say 2,000 mile long trail. I'm forgetting all this now.
I think it's like 2,200.
2,200. Yeah. Yeah. And it runs, it starts in Georgia and runs all the way to Maine. It has, certainly in the southern section, it has a lot of beautiful forested mountains. Towards the north, you start getting into the Presidential Range. But I mean, it's a long hike. You're living on a trail. You're having to go and pick up, you know, at post offices or whatever. You've got to pick up supplies as you're hiking through. So you've got to coordinate with someone or have it planned out before you go out there. But you're basically living in the woods for a few months. Typical way that people do it is from south to north, and then you can start earlier so that it's warmer on the southern section, but it's not summer warm. It's not boiling hot. And so then by the time you get to the northern section, you're kind of moderating your temperatures by doing the southern to northern route for a lot of people. Yeah. That's the preferred way to do it. Yeah. And then there's kind of a boring section in Pennsylvania that people always complain about. I haven't visited that.
There always is.
Yes. There's sort of in the middle, there's some stuff that isn't that exciting. So that's my spiel.
That's the shape.
And how long does it take to hike it?
It depends. I mean, I think the fastest on record, there's a woman who with sort of a support team, you know, handling all the logistics of like eating and drinking and sleeping, ran it in something insane, like 40 days or something like that. We were kind of on the fast end, and it took us in total trail time a little less than 5 months. You know, in calendar time, it was a bit more than that because we hopped on a Greyhound bus to go to a wedding for a couple of days. But about 5 months, I would say, is like five to 7 months is probably your band of expectation.
And how did you just decide to take 5 months off and hike?
Oh, man. So if you ask me, this story really starts at a bar in 2008 with getting stuck. My friend Boots and I getting stuck in a conversation with someone who was doing an Ironman and wouldn't shut the fuck up about it.
I'm sorry to interrupt the beginning, but you said your friend's name is Boots. Now, I know people get trail names. Is that a trail name?
It was not. I mean, it was his trail name, but it he had it before going on the trail.
Okay.
So, you know, we were young, we were at some like happy hour type thing, which it seems just cruel to complain about now in this lockdown moment. But we got pinned down by someone who, you know, was just Iron Man this, Iron Man that, blah, 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 blah. And Boots, who had a background, had been a chemical engineering undergrad, but was like me working as a bartender at the time, tried to break that up by saying, well, you know what? I actually am doing a Rubidium Man challenge tomorrow, which I had no idea what the fuck he was talking about, but, you know, it broke the conversation up, and the person was like, Rubidium Man, what's that? And he was like, it's where you have 12 hours and you walk as far as you can and you see how far you've walked. And, you know, and I was like, what, like, what are you talking about? He had made it up because he was so sick of hearing about the Iron Man thing. And then as I found out that like rubidium is actually this metal on the periodic table that has all the properties of iron, but is like only 1/10 as strong as iron. And so it was quite the inside joke. But then the next day, I mean, we were just like, you know, total like footloose like shitheads. We had nothing to do, so you know, he woke up at 7 and put a couple of pairs of socks in his backpack and started walking, and walked from our place, which was at Cortez and Ashland, basically all the way up past the Great Lakes Naval Base in 12 hours. And
oh wow. Yeah
we I it was you know, I mean, no one cared, but I was pretty impressed that he had walked that far. And he ended up, he had been on a pre-med track in undergrad and sort of realized partway through that he didn't want to be a doctor, and had then, you know, sort of entered this period of, what am I doing with my life? I just, you know, walked 12 miles to prove a point to a person who I haven't, who's never going to know that I proved the point to them. He ended up doing the Peace Corps in southwestern Tanzania in a village called Madibira. And I had actually gone out to visit him for about a month while he was out there. And it's like super illuminating experience to see the world like that. Like, this place is like four, or was at the time, I have no idea what the condition is now, 4 hours from like the nearest paved road. Like, there's one bus that runs off-road every couple of days, and no electricity, running water, or anything like that. But you know, you spend some time, you start to realize pretty quickly that it's like, once you sort of hit on a set of standard living conditions, like, people are people to a very large extent. But he was there for 2.5 or 3 years, maybe. And then when he came back to the States, you know, it's pretty customary for Peace Corps volunteers to come back and do like a fundraising project for something that was going on in the place that they were staying. And for him, it was actually a situation wherein, like, there was no hospital. And by hospital, I don't mean what you think of, like, you know, it's not Massachusetts General Hospital. I'm talking like place with an x-ray machine, you know, and refrigeration to store like certain medicines or vaccines or whatever, within like, you know, 300 miles in any direction. And he had hooked up with an NGO who was sort of dedicated to the idea of trying to build a hospital in this region. And they had basically said, yeah, like, we kind of have the plans drawn up, but to build the first building, it's like, we just need like 25 grand, 20 grand or something, which is, I mean, that's a result of, you know, a dollar goes a long way in that part of the world.
Right.
And he was kicking around the idea with me, and he was like, you know, I don't think I could get any, I don't think I could drum up that kind of money by like running a 5K. But what if I did like a, you know, a 2000K at like 1 cent per mile or whatever. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, let's do the Appalachian Trail. And at the time I was like 20, what was I? I was like 24, 25. And thought it was kind of a gnarly idea. And the conceit was like, yep, what you can do is you can pledge like 0.5 cent per mile or 1 cent per mile or 10 cents per mile. And however far we get, you donate that amount of money to the Mufindi. It was the Mufindi Highlands Orphans Project is the name of the NGO that was building the hospital. And so we decided we were going to do it. And then we recruited our buddy Gower and then our other buddy Danger. And Gower is Gower's last name. Danger is Danger's legal name. When he turned 18, he changed his legal name to Danger. It was a coin flip between that or Nintendo. And the four of us, you know, decided, like, if we're going to do it, we're going to do it. So we started doing training hikes in Chicago about this time of year, 10 years ago in 2011. And we would, like, load up a backpack with, like, books and, you know, clothes and whatever and walk around in the snow. And we started from Springer Mountain, Georgia, March 2nd or March 3rd. 2011, and yeah, and from there just did a through hike to Mount Katahdin in Maine 2200 miles later. And you know, I mean, this is the type of thing where it's like, we actually did the least work of anybody involved here, in a sense, in that, like, the hospital, the first building of the hospital ended up opening about a year and a half after this, and it was like, yeah, like, in a sense, like, we had something to do with it, but it's like, we, A, obviously didn't build the hospital, but we also like right. didn't make the money that people donated to build the hospital, you know, like, like we didn't have $25,000, but we were able to get people who did have, you know, collectively among them $25,000 to donate money to do it. But yeah, it was like a 5-month thing. And I don't know. I mean, I would kind of pause here and let you guys guide the conversation as far as how granular you want to get. Cause I mean, I can go by like most miserable moments or funnest stuff or state by state, or, you know, whatever lens we want to view this through. I'm more than happy to nerd out on it.
Let's get some crazy trail stories.
Right.
I'm always drawn to think statements like most miserable moment.
Yeah.
Man, most miserable moment. So the most at a couple of, in the main, like of the three transcontinental trails that run north to south through the country, there's the Appalachian Trail in the eastern half of the country. There's the Continental Divide Trail that runs through Colorado and through the middle part of the country, or the 2/3 west, I suppose. And then there's Pacific Crest Trail, which runs like through the Sierra Nevadas and California. The Appalachian Trail, like, probably is the least conducive to abject misery, but I would say 3 points really stand out to me. The first one was like 4 days in. It's March, it's in Georgia, and as Chris mentioned, that it's like, you know, you have the idea, especially being from Chicago as I am, that it's like, oh, Georgia, it's probably summer there all year round. and it's not. It's like, oh, it's like 33 degrees and raining. This sucks. Yeah. And we ended up not able to like agree on a place to camp for the night. So not in very like trail ready condition. We did like an 18-mile day, let all of our shit get all the way soaked through and wet. And then tried to like put the tent up on top of Blue Mountain in Georgia. And it was like, as we would later find, it's like, this is like the most weather exposed like campsite on the entire Appalachian Trail. And we had this tent like put up, and we're such idiots. Like, we didn't really know how to do it. So we put the tent up and it's in standing water, and it feels like there's just, you know, the gods are running roller coasters around us. And didn't sleep a wink, like just terrified the entire night. And then you wake up in the morning and, you know, you have stupid fingers, which is just that phenomenon where it's like you get so cold at your extremities that it's like you lose the dexterity in your hands. And you hit this like moment of panic's not the right word. You hit this moment of like, oh shit, like this isn't just a goof off, where it's like, I know that I'm really cold and under rested and need to start hiking, but I also know that I can't hike until I put the tent away. And I know I can't put the tent away because my hands don't work. And it's like just the supreme like frustration and anger at yourself that then you have to figure out like how to deal with. So that was a moment, you know. And also it was like to get your feet warm, you end up just like stomping your feet on the ground as hard as you can. And it's like you feel like you're, you know, one of Napoleon's soldiers retreating from Moscow or something. It was very archaic. So that was one miserable point. Then for me personally, I hit a point of misery in southwestern Virginia. I think it was Easter Sunday, 2011, where, you know, one of my vanities in life is I'm a super fast hiker. Like I had never really been hiking before this trip. And I was like, man, I can fucking tear up some trail if I get going. And we were going along the like stretch of the Appalachians, along the southern part of the Virginia, West Virginia border. And it was April and it started to get hot. And I was in a rush to meet the next waypoint for whatever reason that was obviously dumb. And I skipped I skipped a water source. And after I skipped the water source, like I started to just like sweat profusely. And by skipping a water source, I mean that like you actually have to stop at a stream and you know, run water through a filter and fill up your canteen or water bladder or whatever. And I had decided not to do that because, you know, I don't know. I obviously had a hot date to keep. but as I'm then going up the side of this like really exposed mountain, I think it was called Floyd Mountain, but I'd have to look back. I started to like actually experience, you know, when you're a summer lifeguard or whatever, they train you on the signs of like heat stroke. And you're like, I'm never going to see anyone having this happen. I'm a lifeguard at a summer pool. And it was like, my heart started to beat in all sorts of fucked up rhythms. And all my buddies had then like passed me and been like, are you okay? And I was like, yeah, I'm fine. And, you know, I stopped sweating. Like my skin was like cold.
Oh, that's, yeah.
And like, I couldn't go more than like 100 steps before I literally felt like I was going to collapse and die. And it was one of those things where I was like, I don't feel like safe right now. But I also like, I had the ability to like quit, then I would have quit. But it's almost like that episode of The Office when Michael Scott is like, I declare bankruptcy. Like, I can't just like be on the side of a mountain in the middle of fucking nowhere and be like, I quit. It's like,
right.
You know, you got to get up and you got to do the 100 steps and do the 100. And like, by the time you do that and get to the next shelter, it's like, all right, let's keep going. But I ended up like having actual heat stroke. And I mean, my body's still fucked up in response to heat at this point in my life, but it was not a fun scene. And then we had the last piece that was pretty gnarly. And this gets more near to Chris's neck of the woods. There's this area in Maine called Mahoosuc Notch, which is...
Yeah.
This like land of the lost prehistoric boulder field where it's like it's not even technical climbing because like it's so random that it's like you have to go through this like little nightmare corridor of like here's 24 feet where you have to take off your pack and like put your arms at your sides and inch forward on your toes, and then here's this stretch where it's like it's totally dark or you have to go on this incline or whatever. And so we're in the middle of this boulder field, and Boots, who had a history of shoulder troubles, his shoulder comes out of socket. And it's not even like we're on flat ground. Like we're perched on like this rock, and his shoulder is not like slightly out. It's full on out. You know, you can like see the bulb of the humerus like pressing against the skin in a place that it shouldn't be. And he's in a tremendous amount of pain, and, you know, we're trying to get it back in and it's not going in. And you're just in this situation where it's like, there's not a way we could call for help because there's no like cell service here or anything. But two, even if we called for help, like there's no like motorized vehicle that can come get to us. And, I mean, there's a video up on YouTube that we made of this that we called 127 minutes. That was just us fucking around trying to get his shoulder back in. But it was actually the point, and we had been on for 4.5 months at that point. We were very close to the end, but I was pretty sure that we weren't going to finish at that point because you can just sort of like get these glimpses of like, it is not far from this point to like, you know, we're going to really fuck up. You're going to lose your arm or something. And but we ended up finally getting it back in, and then we hiked back to a road, and then we hitchhiked back to a town, and then we kind of licked our wounds in a hotel for a few days, or a motel rather. And, you know, we're able to finish it like with my buddy in a sling, with Boots in a sling. But those were the three most miserable moments. To offer a long answer to a short question.
Yeah. that sounds awful. I mean, that section in Mahoosuc Notch is just crazy. And it's something that it's kind of like, if you're going out for a day hike, it's kind of like, wow, this is fun. But when you've been on the road, when you've been on the trail for a long time and everything and something goes wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they would have had to send people up from Pinkham Notch.
Yeah,
do a litter carry out,
and it was I've really done that. Fun until it wasn't. You've done a litter carry out there?
Yeah, I've done a litter carry out there. Most of what we did was mostly on Mount Washington. That's where people tended to get. And those were the rescues that were actually harder to do emotionally. Because it was saying like, okay, another person did something stupid. Someone has hypothermia on Mount Washington. Let's carry him out. But then there were people who were like really knew what they were doing. And I remember this one woman one time, all she did was she went to get water from a creek and she stepped on a rock and twisted her ankle like really seriously. Like it was so swollen. It was insane. And so we had to carry her out and she just started out saying she didn't want to be carried out and blah, blah. And she was so upset and apologetic and crying. And that was a really hard rescue. There were ones that were physically, people were hurt harder and, you know, much, much more injured than that. But it was, that was a tough one.
Yeah. Wow.
But yeah, that's getting a shoulder back in, is it?
Yeah. And it's like, I know like two or three ways to do it. And then when the two or three ways didn't work, I was like, yeah, I guess we're just going to jam this thing.
Yeah. You know, yeah. You know, in the shows like The Walking Dead, where they get injured and they just keep fighting or whatever, you know, me, I'll fucking twist my ankle and the fucking zombies would be eating me freaking. Yeah. Be like, ah.
Oh, you know what? Mahusig Notch, what that's like is, this is for, you know, Carl and Andy. Do you guys have gone up to Purgatory Chasm, right?
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah. So imagine that whole story happening in Purgatory Chasm. That's what it's like when Mike is saying that it's like bouldering. It's not technical climbing. It's exactly like Purgatory Chasm. And you're having to hike through a section that would be like Purgatory Chasm.
Oh, did you climb at all, Mike? Are you like rope climbing or anything like that?
No, there was none of that. I mean, when you get to Mount Katahdin, like there's some verticality to it, but no, generally speaking, like it's nothing you can't do just with your hands and your feet whole way.
Yeah. Did you like come across a brewery or something like while you were like grubbing through the jungle or whatever, like did you all of a sudden come across like a restaurant or a brewery and just
an oasis?
Carl, let me tell you about a little thing I like to call the Port Clinton Massacre.
Yeah.
So there's a town in Pennsylvania called Port Clinton, and it's a very small place. And by the time you get to Pennsylvania, if you're northbound, it's like it's late May, and the combination of humidity and heat and just the long days can really be demoralizing. And for a lot of people, they get this thing called prickly heat, which is something that an account of sailors in like the South Pacific in the 1800s would mention, where your sweat pores get so backed up with perspiration that your sweat starts to like go out under like at a subcutaneous level, and it feels like horrible, and it's just like it's so miserable. So we go down this ravine into Port Clinton, and I would guess, like, aggressively, it's a town of 300 people. And, you know, as many small towns in the eastern part of the country are, it's like it's laid on a fairly compact grid, and they actually have a gazebo at the edge of town where hikers are allowed to, like, sleep. And the only non-residential building in the town is the firehouse, and it's a volunteer fire department. And we're just grateful to have the gazebo, and Boots and Danger and I, Gower stayed asleep. Boots, Danger and I are sort of like, man, it really seems like there's a lot of people going in and out of the firehouse. So we walk up to the firehouse and we walk in, and it's like this volunteer fire department has basically turned the entire thing into a bar. But it's a members only bar where like the only people who are allowed in are members of the fire department or their guests. And so they were like, oh, you guys are hikers. You can hang out. And, you know, we at this point, it's like we're running at a calorie deficit of like negative 4,000 calories a day. We haven't had a sip of alcohol in like 3 months. And they're just plying us with like as much beer as we can drink. And it's like every cliche of like super small town drinking establishments is happening there. That's like they have the pull tab game behind the bar, where it's like you pull the tab and it's like a scratch off system within the bar, and people are like losing hundreds of dollars on that. And you know, we're like trading stories with the volunteer, or just like, it's like the scene in Jaws where they're comparing injuries, right? Where you're just like showing up in cars and like sharing tales of woe. And then, you know, I mean, I'll share this now because my mother has since passed away, so it won't mortify her, any more than she is, I suppose. But, way we got back from the firehouse at the gazebo is there was this guy that we were talking to all night who was like, I'm the best race car driver in the world. I just haven't gotten my shot yet. And we're like, bull fucking shit. Like, I'm the best race car driver. He's like, get in my car. And we're like, okay. Oh, man. And then we're like going like 100 miles an hour down the streets of this town, like telling this guy that it sucks. So that was a memorable one. The Port Clinton massacre. Generally speaking, at some other like great spots, it's not really the brewery so much as it is like the random places. There's a place in the middle of nowhere in Virginia called the Red Bar Restaurant that if I was on death row, I would want the triple cheeseburger from this place. It's like 3 1-pound patties served between slices of Texas toast. I don't even know if there's any like cheese or accoutrement on it. It's just like, you know, you're so hungry at that point that like the calorie bomb is euphoric. As you get up into the Northeast, like Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, you end up in what's called kind of deli to deli hiking, where it's like the trail inevitably intersects with a Boar's Head deli gas station every like 5 miles. So yeah. You're eating like 4 1-pound sandwiches per day, and that's something I'll always remember fondly.
Is there interesting hiking culture that you can talk about and traditions and stuff like that that you pick up along the way?
There is. I mean, it's I feel like it's like any subculture where it's like there's the people who are like really contributing and making it kind of the rich thing that it is. And then there are the people who are sort of parachuting in and sort of being douchebags about it.
Yeah.
That there's this tradition of, for instance, like trail names, and, you know, you sort of will see people on this ping pong schedule of, you know, you're seeing this person in Virginia and then you don't see them again until, you know, Massachusetts or whatever. And you are able to like follow their progress through trail registers or gossip or anything like that.
Yeah.
And like in general, like the people you meet through that system are like really generous and interesting and the people you'd like to spend a lot of time with. But then you would get like, I'm just, what springs to mind immediately is like, you know, we were like 3 weeks in and there's this guy being like, people call me Hawk. You know,
it's like, yeah.
No one calls you Hawk. Like, you call yourself Hawk and you're trying to tell yourself that like you're the coolest person out here. So the culture is generally really good because everyone is sort of democratized and laid low by the physical challenge of it. You know, that it's like posers get exposed or drop off really quickly. I think I read something that like only 1 in 5 people actually kind of like finishes the through hike. But the trappings of the culture are pretty like fraternal and cool, which in the early going, to my mind, like led to a lot of eye rolling for people who were like a little too eager to grab their spot.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a weird, it's a weird thing. We were really lucky being in New Hampshire that most of the time, because most of the through hikers, I don't know if you did this, Mike, at all, but it was very common for them to, basically we'd let them stay for free in the huts in the White Mountains. And it would be kind of like, you know, just clean up some dishes, help clean up after dinner and help with the dishes or something. And, you know, if we've got room, you can crash here and we'll give you a free meal. But everyone kind of knew each other. So what we mostly heard were the nightmare stories of the people who dropped out, who were like complete nightmares beforehand. But there was some guy who was hiking it with his daughter and everyone was like, this guy is weird. And the guy was weird. There was nothing wrong with him. I don't know, but it just, sometimes people just seem off. And then if you encounter someone like that and you're in the woods alone with them,
Right.
It just accentuates your like your wariness of them.
I mean, there was definitely the not uncommon experience, especially in the early going, of like, wow, this person seems very off-putting. And I guess I'm just about to go to sleep 6 feet from them, right? You know, like in the shelters. So it, I can only speak to what it was like having three good friends with me every night. Like doing it on a solo basis, I think would be a lot more intimidating.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
And so one thing, I mean, when I was, you know, the time that I was there was before cell phones. Were people using them at that, you know, because cell phones were much more common, obviously, by then. Were people using their cell phones and digital maps at all?
No, this actually has triggered a memory for me. So I'm 36 years old, and I joke with like my buddies from high school, like we're sort of this weird time capsule, mini cohort within a generation, in that like, not only were we the sort of last class of people to graduate high school, to go through 4 years of high school when no one had a cell phone.
Right.
But like when we hiked the trail in 2011, no one had any of that stuff. It was like, we had a BlackBerry that we used when we would get to a town to like update our trip blog. But, you know, like six out of nine nights, or I guess two out of three nights in that way, like there was no actual connectivity when you were sleeping out on the trail.
Right.
And the thing that I remembered was when we got all the way to the very, very tail end of the trail, the last 100 miles prior to Mount Katahdin, which is the northern terminal of the trail, there, it's called the 100-mile wilderness. Like there's no, right, there's no road intersection, there's no gas stations or anything. And we started to hear trail gossip about this guy called the Walking Dude, who like had like tried to start going south from Maine to Georgia, but with like a laptop and a remote modem and all this stuff. And it was like, is this true? Or is this like someone trying to prove this? But then we actually encountered the Walking Dude like 3 days before we finished. And it was true. It's like, he had like a 2008 Dell, like 13-pound computer with like an external battery and hard drive that he's like carrying around, like asking people if they knew where Wi-Fi was. And I was like, holy shit. Like, yeah. And there was like a real bare bones website called White Blaze and Trail Journals. I don't know if those are two related websites or two different websites, but it was like people would stop in public libraries at towns along the trail route and like, you know, do very brief text-based updates of how they were doing. And that was like the way you would follow someone's journey through the trail. Now it's like everyone's on Instagram all the time. And, you know, I think data coverage and everything has totally changed. So the same way that I kind of feel like I was part of the last group of kids to go through high school without cell phones being a factor. Like, I feel like I was probably close to one of the last cohorts to go through the trail without, you know, omnipresent smartphone coverage being a factor.
Right. Yeah. I see a lot of stuff sometimes, you know, people saying like, oh, you know, it's, you know, call this number if you get into trouble. And I mean, it, you know, when I was working up there, it was kind of, you know, hike to the nearest hut, and someone would radio. In my first summer there, I was working at Pinkham Notch. I was the crew chief for the Pinkham Notch information desk. And so the radio would go off and we'd be like, oh my God. And so we'd have to get on the phone and arrange rides and get a rescue crew out somewhere. But now apparently people just call the front desk. So I think that's
crazy. I mean, I imagine it having been previously like Gondor asking for help from Rohan. If you need to.
Right. Yes.
Exactly. Like the fires.
Yeah.
Fires just going across the peaks. Yeah.
Mike, did you forage anything on the trail?
Only a very, very scant amount. The as you get up to Maine, there's blueberries everywhere, and like genuinely wild blueberries, and those things are phenomenal. By and large, though, did I forage anything? I don't think so. I mean, as you're walking through the southern part of the country, like it's actually, you know, still basically winter, and you know the country hasn't woken up yet. And then as you get to the mid-Atlantic states in May, you're doing the Dilly to Dilly hiking, as I mentioned earlier. So why the fuck would you forage anything? No, I had some like semi-interesting wildlife encounters, but yeah, generally speaking, no foraging.
Any fisher cats?
Yes.
Oh,
I ran into a fisher cat and I was like, what the fuck is this thing?
Right.
And I still don't quite know, but
it's like a weasel, a giant weasel.
Yeah. And it was the type of thing where I was like zoned out, just like walking. And I realized the thing was like 3 feet in front of me. And it looked like something from the movie Critters. And I was very scared of it.
Yeah. They're pretty wild. They would hunt rabbits a lot in New Hampshire.
They eat everybody's pets here in Massachusetts.
Yeah. I remember a little kid when I was working a tent site, and this little kid in the morning comes running up to me, and he was like, I don't know, maybe like 8 or something. He's like, look at what I found. Look at what I found. And he's holding a rabbit head by the ear. And
oh, my God.
It was just the head. And I was like, oh, yeah, it's a Fisher. Fisher got it.
Yeah,
but the kid was so like, I'm gonna take it home, and I'm like, right. Oh, go for it, kid.
Lucky rabbit's head,
right? Wow. Exactly,
a lucky rabbit's disembodied head.
Yeah, I had like the only real scary wildlife moments I can remember were I was in Shenandoah National Park and I rounded a bend and I was like 12 feet away from a baby bear. And man, that thing was fucking cute, but it was like, oh my God,
where's mama?
This is the thing. And, you know, I backed away and the bear backed away, but that was one thing.
That's your revenant moment.
that was my revenant moment. And I'm still waiting for the royalty checks to come in.
Yeah.
And then, where was it? It was in Massachusetts, I think. I was going up a fairly vertical mountain and ended up like stepping up face to face with a rattlesnake was sunning itself like 2 inches away. And we were both like, oh, fuck, you know, and nothing bad happened, but that was that. And then in Maine, you know, by the time we got all the way up to Maine, we were just sort of been like, we got to fucking finish this. And so you know, it's like, if we have to hike for 3 hours in the dark, we will. And like coming within like 1 or 2 feet of a moose in the dark is just unbelievably disturbing, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like it's like an H.P. Lovecraft thing. Like,
right.
The actual like dimensions of that thing.
Yeah. They're so much bigger when you're close to them. It's one thing to see them like from the car when you're driving down the road, but then when you're like even within, I've gotten within about 10 feet or so of one, and it's just like, holy crap.
It's like, are you a god?
Yeah. They are. There's some Miyazaki film where there's a god that's kind of a moose-like creature.
Yeah, that's Princess Mononoke.
Right. And I totally got that, like having seen moose close up. I was like, oh yeah, that's perfect. I get that.
Yeah. All right, guys. I think we're wrapping up this one. That was freaking awesome. We'll wrap it up on a moose encounter.
All right.
But can I just ask one quick question?
Yeah.
Any Sasquatch encounters?
No Sasquatch encounters.
No Sasquatch, damn it.
But a couple of like really gnarly people needing to drop off the grid encounters cannot believe you're actually having the conversation.
Yeah.
You know, like we ran into one guy in Pennsylvania who was like, I can't tell you guys why, but I need to live in this shelter for the next 3 months. And if anyone ever saw me, you can't tell. you know, one guy who, said his name was Trainwreck. We met him in like some shelter in rural Vermont. And he was like, yeah, man, I just rode my bike out of town and I got to be in Florida in 9 days. So I got to ride my bike all the way to Florida. And I was like, oh, man, dude. yeah. So no Sasquatch, but like human Sasquatch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then what was your trail name?
So we had signs on our packs to like declare ourselves as part of a hospital like fundraising hike. So mm-hmm. I was just hospital hiker number one. Mm-hmm. What was funny was we came to be known as like the hospital hikers among the people who were hiking the trail that year. And we would always one of our friends try to like call ahead to whatever town to see if the town newspaper, radio station or whatever wanted to do a story and get people to kick in like $50 towards like fundraising for the hospital. And so in May or June or whatever, we're hiking at one point and these people like who are hiking or just faster hikers than us come up behind us and see our signs and like, you guys are the fucking hospital hikers. And we're like, yeah, and they're like, holy shit. Have you guys seen it? And I'm like, what are you talking about? And they're like, dude, did you hear about Bin Laden? And I'm like, Bin Laden? No, did something bad happen? They're like, no, we got Bin Laden. And we're like, fuck yeah. And he's like, yeah, but like the Williamsburg newspaper, like had you guys on the front page already. And so the headline of the newspaper says like, Bin Laden killed by U.S. troops, and it's a picture of you guys.
Holy crap!
I know it was like it's great. I've got pictures on our like little trip blog, but
nice.
It was like holy shit.
You gotta send us a copy of that so we can put it on our Instagram.
Yeah.
I'll email it to Chris right now.
Yeah, cool.
That's hilarious.
Although I emailed Chris a bunch of pictures and he never put them up there.
There's still time, Carl.
Oh, I'll put them up there. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you get them?
Let me check.
The Spencer room? No worries.
We'll talk. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry to kill the conversation.
Yeah, no problem. So Mike, what's your links?
My links like to the trail stuff?
Whatever you want to promote. You can promote Guild Row if you want.
I mean Guild Row, if anyone listening to this has the question, what is Guild Row? They probably already know what Guild Row is. If you want to find out more about the hike, we have a decaying trip blog. With links that are breaking by the day. It's Mufindi Hospital Hike -blog.tumblr.com. MUFINDIHOSPITALHIKE-blog.tumblr.com. I'll also send Chris just the link here. From there, you can find, the YouTube channel we had and the different things we had going on. I'm happy to report that, the Mufindi Highland Orphans Project has actually created a pretty substantial medical complex in an area of the world that didn't have one previously. So
nice.
They're all doing like fucking amazing work, obviously millions of times beyond the scope of like four idiots goofing around on the Appalachian Trail. But I'll email this to Chris and you guys will have it. But yeah, that's, I guess, the link I would share apropos of this podcast. You guys, this is so much fun.
Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us.
Of course. And believe me, anytime you want me to come on and tell stupid stories, I am ready, willing, and able.
Excellent.
All right. We are.
Chris, where are you?
I'm right here. Can you hear me?
No, yeah. Where are you? Like. Yeah.
What's your links, Chris?
Oh, well, yeah. Livefirecook.com, Livefirecook on Instagram. Livefirecook anywhere online is probably me.
I'm at andyrasama.com. I have a new book out about science comics, the digestive system. If you look up science comics, the digestive system online, you can find a way to get your hands on it.
MadCarl.com, MadSpiral.com, and Carl Ristaino, R-I-S-T-A-I-N-O, on Facebook and Instagram. And I know you guys are from Chicago, and in the Prohibition, when you were, you went to a when you went to a Chicago speakeasy, and they ran out of bathtub gin, they said, "You can't stay here. No, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay in the speakeasy. Get the hell out of the speakeasy and the art shed."
Dang, Carl, you actually finally nailed the line.
Wow.
It's been over 25 episodes, but you finally hit it.
I wouldn't say nail is too strong a word.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
But
yeah.
Probably like tack.
Yeah. Thanks to Mike Keeley for being on the show. Thanks to Chris and Carl for helping host. Thanks to Ed Guild and Andy Desbago for the Mad Carl Stomp. Thanks to everyone listening and subscribing or whatever you do with a podcast. I don't know anymore. See you all next week.